Episode 140 of Futures Radio Show, sponsored by CME Group, the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. CME Group's markets help individuals and businesses around the world manage risk and seize opportunities. Learn more at futuresfundamentals.com.
Every day, traders and investors dive in to tackle the ever-changing markets to find opportunity. Futures Radio Show is your number one source for answers to the questions that all market participants want to ask. Veteran futures trader Anthony Crudele sits down with the most influential leaders and top traders in the industry. Now, here's your host, Anthony Crudele.
Hey everyone, before we get started today, I want to thank all of our sponsors, CME Group, Trading Technologies, and Top Step Trader. Now today I spoke to Anas Alhaji. He studied economics and law in Saudi Arabia, then went to the University of Oklahoma to study petroleum. He earned his PhD and did research focused around OPEC's influence in the oil industry. Today Anas and I talked about forecasting oil and gas markets, understanding OPEC, shale oil and gas, and what disruptive technologies will impact energy markets over the next decade and beyond. As usual, thank you all for listening, and please enjoy this episode. Anas, welcome to the show.
Hello, Anthony.
It's great to speak with you today. Now, I've been following you on Twitter, reading your reports for some time, so it's really a pleasure to be able to speak with you today, and I know our audience is really going to enjoy hearing from you. Now, you're a researcher, economist, writer, speaker on the oil and gas market, and I find it to be very interesting, a lot of the things that you write about and speak about. So we're going to talk about some of those things today, but before I do, since you do it all and you understand the industry extremely well, I'm curious how you got your start. Talk to us about choosing to do this for a living, and then talk to us a little bit about your current role in the energy industry.
It was kind of very strange because I was studying law and economics in the undergrad, and all of a sudden I took a course in petroleum economics, and the guy, the instructor was really good, and he kind of made me love the industry. Then I took another course with him, and that's how I fell in love with this type of work. Just to mention that this guy became later very famous and became the Minister of Enterprise in Egypt for 14 years. So he was kind of really well known, and he knew his stuff. And that's what mentors do, basically. He helped me get into it. And what made it more interesting is when I graduated, I told him I want to go, and I was studying in Saudi Arabia at that time. I told him I want to go study in the United States. And he said, go to the University of Oklahoma. It's number one in petroleum. So I did.
Okay, so take me back to having him as a mentor. And I know from my own personal experience, I would have never been able to make it in this industry without a mentor. Talk to us about some of the moments and conversations that you had that really got you excited about this industry, because obviously you have to have a really strong motivation because you're doing a lot. I mean, like you said, you're doing research, you're an economist, you're writing, you're speaking, you're doing a lot. And I know that just from what I'm doing on the podcast and in my trading life, it takes up a lot of time. So it takes a lot of motivation to do it. And what did he do or say that really got you, your interest peaked?
Well, one of the major things he did was everything you read about oil, basically in books or in the media, especially about the history of the oil industry and the history of OPEC, basically is completely biased. And he was debunking most of the things that we written. And that was intriguing. And I love that. And as I went and did my research, basically, I found out that he was right on most of the stuff he said. And the history of the oil industry is completely biased.
So basically, you wanted to come out with an unbiased look of the industry.
That's exactly the case. And that's what I've been doing for the last probably 25 years or so, that I was trying kind of to bring the industry from the extreme side, bring it to the middle. And even my research work, when I did my master's and PhD, was focused on that because my research was on market structure and the role of OPEC. And I found out that most of the research, the academic research, was completely biased, and it does not even fit with the principles of economics.
Yeah, see, that's so great to hear, because the industry needs people like you to be able to step out and do that, because really, like you said, there is so much bias out there. We're really in everything we do nowadays. It just seems like politically in every little aspect of our life, everything is spoken with a bias behind it. And it's very hard to get pure research that is on the topics that we're interested in. So I commend you for going out and getting the motivation to do that. And it shows in your work, and it really does. And talk to us about what you're currently doing right now in the industry.
Oh well, I just started a new company called Energy Outlook Advisors. And basically, what we do is we do consulting, advising, research, of course, and I do a lot of speaking. And I think I find speaking kind of in lieu of teaching, because I really love teaching, but I don't have the pleasure of doing it right now. So speaking is compensating for that teaching thing that I want to do. But mostly is based on research. So I do the research, and I work on oil outlook, gas outlook, LNG outlook, and everything else affecting the market, whether politics or natural stuff, technical, disruptions, everything you talk about.
Interesting. So let's talk about forecasting the market, the oil market. No easy feat there. And, you know, typically at the end of this show, I go through rapid fire questions, and you and I were talking about these rapid fire questions before we came on today. And you said, oh, I have the story to tell about when forecasting just clicked for me. So before we get into talking about how you forecast the oil markets, talk to us about that story that you want to share with us.
Well, the bottom line is, if you know the history, if you have the theory, you have the data, and you have the right method for forecasting, the bottom line is stand your ground. Independence is the key to forecasting. And whenever you lose that independence, basically, you will be definitely wrong. And if you get it right, it's just a coincidence. The story is in early 2009, that's after the financial crisis and the start of the recession. I did my report, and I predicted that oil demand will decline by 1.4 million barrels, that the global oil demand. And my boss basically walked to my office. He was a bit angry, and he said, look, I'm not going to name the banks here, and they are investment banks and various consulting homes, our houses. He dropped some reports and said, look, they are predicting 3 million barrel decline in 2009. And I told him, well, it's 1.4. And he got angry because of that. So every day he started coming to my office, just throwing the reports at me, saying, okay, look at this bank, 2.8. Look at this bank, 3.2. Look at this consulting house, it's 2.9. Look at every day like this for about 2 weeks. And then he came back to me and he said, look me in the eye and tell me you are confident, because what I'm going to do with all the report that the average is 3 million decline, and you are saying it's only 1.4 decline. So look me in the eye, because I'm going to have a $1 billion deal tomorrow, and I want to know what to do. So I stood up, look him in the eye. I said, I'm confident. And he said, okay, well, that's what's going to go to all books, and that's what we are going to use. Well, at the end of the year, we got the right numbers, or the final numbers, and the final number was 1.36.
That's awesome. It goes back to what you said. You have to believe in what you're doing. And that's why when I talked about at the beginning of the show, you have to have a real motivation in this business, because let's face it, and anything to do with markets, it's tough. It's not easy, and you have to really love it. You have to passion. And at least I know from my experience that passion and love for the markets is what's carried me through over the years. You know, I don't know that it's really skill, you know, right? It's one of those things where you just have to really want it more than somebody else, and you have to really believe in yourself. And that's what really ultimately, I think, tips the scale and gets you to where you want to be. You have to have that vision of yourself, of reaching that. So I really enjoyed that. Now, let's dig into some details here. I mean, forecasting the oil markets, I mean, like I said before, this is no easy feat, right? I mean, I read a lot of different people talking about forecasting oil markets, and it is, I can't imagine, because I'm a technical trader, having to go through the fundamentals and figure out what's going on here. Because as I've had other people on here that forecast the markets, it seems to me like a lot of times the data you're looking at or some of the things that people are showing are, they could be lying about it. And it's just like, how do you dissect, you know, what's really truthful information from not truthful information and so on and so forth. I mean, I want to go through what your process is. Talk to us kind of from beginning to end. I mean, obviously, we don't have to get into extreme detail here, but talk to us about forecasting the oil market.
First idea and the most important, basically, like I said, independence. If you have certain thoughts from the beginning or certain biases, it's not going to work, whatever you do. Even if you have the best mathematical model or the best econometric model and you have the best computer program, if you are biased from the beginning, it's not going to help you. You have to be independent. And the second most important basically is you have to have a theory. Whatever you are doing has to match the theory. If it doesn't match the theory, it does not make sense. Let me give you an example. As oil prices increased in 2007 and 2008, we have many people from the finance part of academia who never knew a single thing about the oil market start writing academic papers, sending it for publications, simply because they use finance models, the data is there, and they think they can publish a paper on the oil market. The failure was the theory does not support them, and the history of the oil market does not support them. So many of them basically wasted valuable time doing work that was worthless because it does not match this theory and does not match the history. And if you consider the history as part of the theory, then it's all about the theory. So they have to have a theory. An example I used to tell my students all the time, especially when we talk about correlations. Correlations most of the time are useless. And an example basically is there is always a strong correlation between the number of traffic lights and the number of cats in any city. So that's what really correlation is. You need to go deeper than that, really, to understand what's going on. And to go deeper, you need to know the theory. Then, of course, you need to have the right formulation of the mathematical models that match the theory. And, of course, the data. And the data, basically, you have to clean it up so you have kind of a clean set to work with. And once you do that, you start from the beginning, basically, with the theory, and you move to the mathematical formulation, and then the data, whatever results you get. And this is kind of important here, because people think if they got no results, then it's bad. No, no result is a result. A failure of the model is a result. And this is part of forecasting when you say this, because one of the best models I work with, and I'm still using it until today in forecasting, it fails every time the Saudis basically crash the market. Just the market, the model does not work anymore. But what the model is doing really, it's predicting. It's saying that the market is going to crash, but it does not work after that.
Interesting. So let me ask you this. Are you, when you say you're doing forecasting, are you doing it purely from a fundamental basis, or are you doing any sort of technical analysis as well?
Just fundamental basis, basically. I'm not using technical analysis at all, because the technical analysis at the end are embedded in it anyway. It's just technical analysis, probably more useful on short-term day-to-day basis. The models I work with basically are not good for day-to-day basis. They are good for longer-term, probably months and years in this case. So they are better off with trends in general than specific numbers.
Can you talk to us about one of your latest forecasts?
I'm going to speak in general.
Yeah, general.
On the oil market. The oil market basically is improving, especially over the summer, and prices will improve. The Saudis are doing an amazing job, basically, in terms of uniting OPEC and keeping everyone in order, although not everyone is following the Saudis. But in my view, of course, everything is about Saudi Arabia. It's not about OPEC, and we can talk about that. But the issue is, okay, what's going to happen after the summer? The market is still weak because we have the level of inventories is still very high. And by the way, in forecasting, when you have very high inventories, we have a serious problem here. And probably this is one of the reasons why most forecasts fail during this period, because inventories are like a big, big cushion. Imagine that if I got to throw something at you and you are just carrying a sheet in front of you to trying to protect yourself, and I hit you with something really hard, versus a blanket or versus a mattress or versus five mattresses. And what OPEC did basically just removed one mattress, but you are still hiding behind four mattresses. So whatever punch or whatever thing I hit you with, the impact of it would be very small. So people should not be surprised that OPEC cut is not working that much. OPEC should not be surprised, because the OPEC impact should be looked at the other way. In a sense, we have the glass half full or half empty. If OPEC or the Saudis did not have the cut, oil prices would be in the 20s today. So we are at 48, 49 today. So that's the difference, and that's the impact of OPEC. And that's the other part of forecasting. In a sense, you got to look at the other side. For example, to give you another example, when we look at the increase in shale production in the United States, that's before the decline, we are not supposed to look at the first point versus the second point on the chart. Let's say the data in 2010 versus data in 2011. We should look at the data in 2011 versus the forecasts, the old forecasts for 2011. That's really how you measure the impact. So people say, well, shale increased production only by 4.8. No, because U.S. oil production was decreasing. And if you look at the old forecast, production increased by about 5.4, probably 5.5 million barrels a day. So the impact of shale is way larger than what people are talking about. And that's part of the forecasting process that, or at least the implications of forecasting when we talk about it.
Yeah, see, I find that so interesting, because as myself, as a technical trader who uses a strategy, I like to understand these underlying themes that are happening, because if the driving force behind what's happening in price is coming from fundamentals and it collides with or coincides with my technicals, then you really have, as a trader, I think that's a really good edge. Because if I'm looking at a crude opportunity and it comes up long, it's a bullish look, and I look at your forecasting and we look at things are starting to turn bullish, to me that's a very strong confirmation. And I just mentioned this because so many traders out there are probably going, well, what do I need to know about fundamentals for, or understand forecasting? And I'm saying to myself that I've had to train myself over the years, especially when I'm trading a lot of these markets like oil, maybe not as much with S&P, it doesn't matter, but with those types of markets, you have to understand that, because that could really be the driving force. All of a sudden, the market turns on a dime. Like you said, this is the reason why we're back up here at these prices versus being at 20. And we could look at the charts and maybe come to the same conclusion and say, oh, yeah, it held this level. But when you have that information and knowing that there's something else driving it, it really can help confirm us as traders what we're looking at a technical basis. So I really appreciate that. And I want to talk a little bit about OPEC, because, you know, I'm not someone who is, by any stretch of the imagination, an expert on OPEC. You know, I read tidbits about it, and I'm really someone who follows it, watches it to kind of understand, like I said, understand the theme. I see a lot of criticism out there on Twitter and in the media, way more than I see praise for OPEC. How do you feel about the job they're doing? And I know you spoke a little bit about what they just recently did to help the price of oil, but talk to us about what else we should be looking for coming from OPEC in the coming months.
Most of this talk about OPEC, basically, and most of this displeasure would disappear completely if people realize the following. And this is basically the result of my research over the years. Okay, the market power is not in the hand of OPEC. OPEC basically is just a club of producers. It is not a cartel. And it's to me, it's a zombie and still a zombie. But at the same time, the market is not competitive. And we all know that the market is not competitive. And by the way, when you talk about forecasting, this is another point. If people are modeling the oil market using equations as a competitive model while the market is not competitive, they will get the wrong results. So knowing the market structure is important in this case. So Saudi Arabia has the market power and everything is about Saudi Arabia. So once people realize that, focus on the Saudis, ignore the rest of OPEC, everything will be fine and most of this criticism will disappear. OPEC is a shell, in a sense, for the Saudis to operate, and they do well under that shell, and that's how it functions.
No, that's really good info, because it goes back to what you said at the beginning. I feel like this is already a theme in this show, is talking about biases. If you understand where they're coming from and understand how it works, then that's the advantage of, you know, doing your homework, right? I mean, if you just look at it from some of the things that they say and you don't understand the reasons why they're saying things, then you can, then you, you know, you get a lot of this back and forth talk of, like I said, a lot of criticism. So it's really good to know. I want to talk a little, you already mentioned shale oil and gas. Another thing I'm not very familiar with, and I don't know how many traders are really out there familiar with it. The only thing I know is that it comes from Iraq, and I'm not even sure I'm right about that. I just kind of made that assumption because it's shale, rock, whatever. But talk to us about shale oil and gas and how much of an impact that has on the energy industry as a whole.
Well, this is kind of a two-part question, but I'm going to spend just 1 minute on the first part. When we talk about shale versus conventional. Conventional basically is oil that migrated from the Middle Rock and got stuck somewhere. So it's not necessarily where you find oil that that oil was basically originated there. In shale, basically, that oil is still there, have not migrated, and it's got stuck because that sand or that oil, basically, that rock is very tight, and we need to frack it basically to get it. That's the difference between the two. But on the impact, basically, I'm pleased to report that I am writing a book on that, on the impact, especially on the international impact of shale gas and oil, and I'm happy to announce that on your show. The impact basically is way larger than what people believe. Think about it this way. Let's focus on gas. If you look at shale gas and you look at the number of receiving terminals that we were building in the United States to receive gas from outside so we can use that gas in the United States. The congressional committees, the work by the government and by the Department of Energy, just talking about the gas shortage that we have in the United States and how we are going to solve the energy crisis. Several books being written on this. And all of a sudden, we are not only exporting gas to Mexico and Canada, we are exporting LNG, for God's sake. So imagine the changes in all trends that we have. That shale gas basically is not only changing the economics of energy in the United States, it's changing the economics worldwide. It's changing the economics of Mexico. It's changing the economics of LNG. Not only that, it's changing the energy politics worldwide. Just think of the political implications of the exports of LNG. Now Europe basically has another outlet to look at, just freeing them from Russia, for example. So the implications are just amazing. If you look at oil, oil prices would not be at this level without shale. In fact, if you look at the period between 2010 and 2014, yes, oil prices were 100 or above 100, but look at the price stability that we had at that time. And think about it. We had a price stability and we had the Arab Spring. We lost the Libyan oil, we lost the Egyptian oil, we lost Yemeni oil, we lost the Syrian oil, and yet prices were stable. Why? Because of shale oil in the United States. So the impact is amazing, and I can speak on this forever, but the impact is way larger than what people think.
Well, I'm excited that you're writing a book about this. As I said to you in a prior conversation, I said I want to talk a little bit about shale oil and gas, just because I feel that it's one of those things where I see a lot of people write about it on Twitter. Or I see even some articles on it. It's not obviously as widespread talked about because I think it's more of people that are in that industry that understand it as well. And I think that it was important for us to understand as traders and as consumers of this to know really what it is and the impacts, and you really gave us some great insight on that. Now, I want to talk about disruptive technologies. Now, you're just the kind of person I like to talk to about this because you have a great understanding of the energy markets. And I travel across the country, Europe. I go to all sorts of shows on fintech, and I go to shows on for financial markets. And the one thing I do when I go to all of these shows is I always look to see what is going to be this disruptive technology. I'll never forget the first time I sat into, I was at an FIA conference, and I started hearing about blockchain and just what they were saying, how it's going to impact financial markets. We're seeing that happen now, and this was years ago. And as for you, what do you see right now as a disruptive technology that's going to have an impact or potential impact on energy markets?
I think there is an agreement among a lot of people that the disruptive technology basically is the electric car or the EVs, electric vehicles. But really, is it the disruptive technology? I'm going to make a statement and then we move to the discussion. Think about it this way. It takes 140 million cars, 140 million EVs on the road to reduce oil demand by 5 million barrels a day. And we've been working on this for a long time, and it will take us probably another 20 years, 30 years, depending on whose forecast is, to get to that number. So 140 million, amazing technology, a lot of work onto the batteries and investment, billions and billions of this investment, just to reduce demand by 5 million for every 140 million. Guess what? We increased U.S. oil production through the share revolution by 5 million in 5 years. So which one is disruptive technology?
Wow. It is unbelievable. I mean, and also when you compare the costs.
Correct. So, but let's go with EVs basically. In a sense, people are talking about Uber. They are talking about ride sharing. They are talking about EVs, and they are talking about autonomous vehicles. Okay. Just one statement on Uber. Basically, people, the idea here is people will leave their, they are not going to buy any more cars and start using Uber. Uberization is just a form of urbanization that increases efficiency, but that's it. But people who are leaving their cars or not buying their cars and using Uber, basically, just Uber running the car instead of them. So the impact on demand is almost zero. But you, looking at all those five things, there is one important item, especially for forecasters, they should not forget. This is like, if we conclude that just this one conclusion out of the show, this will be worth it. Rebound effect. Every improvement in technology has a rebound effect. And that rebound effect is very important. This is just like a very obese person, basically. You give him ice cream and you say, oh, I don't want to eat ice cream, I am on diet. And you tell him, well, it's diet ice cream, and he eats double. So we have energy efficiency, but we have larger homes. We have energy efficiency, but we are driving more. That's the rebound effect. So with Uber, for example, the rebound effect is we are using Uber more than taxis because it's convenient, it's safe, and you can get it at any time you want it. So all of a sudden, we are increasing demand for oil in a sense, not decreasing it. For EVs, I am not a denier of the EVs. Yes, we are going to have millions of them. But we get to remember the following, that if we end up by 2040, if we end up with 140 million vehicles on the road, that's only 7% of the total vehicles worldwide. If you end up with 280 million, which is a very massive number, that's only 14 or 15% of the total. So the conclusion of that, the impact of EVs on the demand is really on the growth of demand, not on the demand itself. We need about 500, or we need at least 500 million EVs on the road just to prevent demand from increasing. So just if we are at 98 today, just to keep it at 98, we need 500 million EVs on the road tomorrow so we can stay at 98. But we do have other problems. We don't have time to focus on everything else, but I want to focus on one item only. If I am a policymaker in Washington, what are the problems that EVs will pose for me to kind of, I have to worry about? The first item is lithium, which is used in batteries, exists only in four countries. 99% of lithium reserves exist in four countries only, and they are in the four corners of the world. We are talking here about China, we are talking about Australia, we are talking about Chile, we are talking about Argentina. In terms of production, 95% of the production is coming from four countries. If you compare that to oil, only 38% come from four countries. So if I am a policymaker, will I put my transportation system hostage to China in this case? So that's number one. Number two, how am I going to dispose of those batteries or recycle them? And who is going to pay for it? Because right now we are not paying for it. If we end up with 200 million to 500 million EVs on the road, and they are going to get older, and I need to dispose of those batteries, or I need to recycle them, that will cost money. Who is going to pay for that? It's going to be the general taxpayer or the guy who is buying it. If the guy who is buying it, then the cost of EVs, basically, is going to be high no matter what. The third point for a policymaker need to answer is, assume that we changed all our cars in Europe and the United States to EVs. Let's focus on Europe in particular, where the gallon of gasoline is between $8 and $12. That's per gallon. Most of that are taxes collected by the government. These are revenues, either spent for general purposes or spent to fix the roads. If I get rid of all the gasoline cars, how the government is going to collect tax revenues? And since they are not going to collect them from gasoline, are they going to impose them on EVs? And therefore, the whole economics of EVs is going to change relative to what we have today. So policy, from a policy-making point of view, we have some serious problems and we have questions to answer.
Well, I'm soaking all this in today. I could sit here and listen to you all day, but we have some rapid-fire questions that are coming up. So if you're ready, we're going to move on to those.
Sure.
All right, everyone. Our rapid-fire segment is sponsored by Trading Technologies. Trade the global markets from virtually anywhere with TT, the world's fastest commercially available futures trading platform. Create your account and try it now free at tryttnow.com. First question, how has your forecasting evolved over the years?
Well, it evolved from complex to simple.
As traders and forecasters, there is a lot of information out there. Which resource do you spend the most time on?
Amazingly, Twitter.
What's your favorite book about the oil markets?
I like history books, basically. So it's the first book ever on OPEC. It's called The History of OPEC by Fuad Rouhani, who was the first Secretary General of OPEC.
Now, what's your favorite movie or TV show about the oil markets?
Syriana.
What's the best piece of advice that you've received about forecasting the markets?
Well, basically, the best one is do home your work and stand your ground.
Now, if you can give a piece of advice to new people interested in getting involved in the trading and forecasting business, what would it be?
Do your homework.
If you weren't an energy economist, university professor, speaker, writer, all the great things you do, you'd be doing what?
Woodworker.
A woodworker, right? It's so funny because I always say to everybody after they give the answer, it's never something still inside. Nobody wants to be in front of the screens anymore. It's like we get all sorts of different answers, and typically it's always like, I want to be, I know you'd be in a shop, but you wouldn't be in front of screens. And it's just so funny how we all think that way. Because I know that we spend a lot of time reading. We spend a lot of time in front of screens looking at charts. I mean, you're doing a lot of research on the fundamentals. And it's like, if we weren't doing that, we'd all really like to be doing something less intensive.
Now, I do fantastic work, by the way. But given the work I do, I need to take it on something, and it's the easiest is to take it on wood.
Yep. No, it's a great outlet for you, right? I mean, you go and you don't have to think about anything else. You're focused on that, and you know, it's a very peaceful time to work on it.
Sure.
Yeah. No, I love it. What can I say? This was awesome today, Anas. I really, really enjoyed it. You gave us insight that I have not yet had on the show, and I truly do appreciate your time. Where can people find you on Twitter or maybe even a website to go check out what it is that you're doing?
Twitter at Anas Alhaji, AnasAlhajji. That's probably the best way to communicate with me and find me.
Awesome. Thank you again so much for coming on Futures Radio Show today. And I really look forward to having more conversations with you in the future.
Sure.
Thank you for listening to Futures Radio Show. If you have any questions or comments for myself or my guests, please visit futuresradioshow.com and sign up to be a premium member for free. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.